I want to be taking your Bibles. Go ahead and be opening to John chapter 4. John chapter 4, we'll be getting there here in just a moment. John chapter 4. All right, we were not able to meet on Wednesday night, and so we're going to be playing catch up a little bit this morning. We didn't get to last Sunday. We didn't get to talk about the Samaritan woman at the well. We didn't get to talk about the Sermon on the Mount. So I don't know that we're even going to get to our assigned topic for today. But we're going to try. And if we don't get to it today, then we'll cover it. We'll cover all that on Wednesday night so that we can get caught up and get back on schedule, for next week. But John chapter 4. Okay, we talked about, last week we talked about miracles, in general. We spent a good amount of time on miracles. Last Sunday we talked about Nicodemus, a little bit. Then we talked about the purpose of a parable. All right, in John chapter 4, we talk a little bit about the Samaritan woman at the well. What's taking place at the beginning of John chapter 4? Where do we find Jesus, and why is it significant? Let's read the first three verses before we get to our actual text of verse 4. Mike, if you have that, read that for us, please, the first three verses. All right. If we had a map, where is Judea in relation to Galilee? Okay. Okay, so he's going to have to travel north. All right. And what part, if we were in the old divided kingdom, what kingdom is Galilee going to be in? All right, it's going to be part of the 10 northern tribes. Okay? Now, this is, we could get into some other stuff that we're not going to get into, but here you have somebody from the tribe of Judah that is living where the northern kingdom would have been. Okay? There's some stuff to study there if you have the time. We don't have the time to get into it today. All right? But they're living up here where the northern tribes would have been. Okay? But why, as we're talking about this, the reason that we're going to get into this a little bit is that if Judea is south here and Galilee is over here and it's in the northern, would have been in the northern part, what's between Judea and the northern tribes? Samaria. Okay? How did the Jews feel about Samaria in general? Alright, you think about this for a moment. Jews that lived in the north, if they needed to get down to Jerusalem or Judea, they would cross the Jordan, travel as far south as they needed to, and then cross the Jordan again. If you needed to get from the south to the north, you would cross the Jordan, travel as far north as you needed to, and then cross the Jordan again. That was just general practice of the Jews at this time. Now, I find it interesting the wording of John here, in verse 4. He needed to go to Galilee. He needed to go to his home region. And he says in verse 4, and he must needs go through Samaria. Why would any Jew, self-respecting Jew, as they might have thought of it, why would any self-respecting Jew need to go through Samaria? They hadn't lost anything there. Okay? One, that could be part of it. Why else? Okay? Alright, another way to look at it. He needed to do that. What else? Okay. At this particular point in Jesus, look, John doesn't cover a whole lot of Jesus' life. Okay? This is actually going to be in the latter parts of Jesus' ministry. Okay? Jesus is beginning to run short on time. Okay? So that could be a big factor. That he's going to cut off as much time as he can. Crossing the Jordan, traveling north and crossing the, it's going to add at least one full day to your journey rather than going in a straight line. At least, if not two or three days. Depending on the time of the year. And something significant there as well is that they would do that at all times of the year. The Jordan flooded, big time at certain times. And so there were times that people would risk their lives rather than travel through Samaria. People would risk their lives to go across the Jordan to avoid Samaria altogether. But it's interesting to me that it says of Jesus, he must needs go through Samaria. There was some need for him to go through there. And I think a big part of this is he still had some lessons to teach his disciples. Okay? How do we find, now, as we're going to read it here in just a moment, but what is the reaction of the disciples when they returned to find Jesus talking to the woman at the well? They were shocked. They were surprised. Right, scandalized. We'll get to that here in a moment because there are a couple of factors at play here with Jesus talking to this woman. Okay? But let's read verses 4 through 24 real quick and then we'll talk a little bit more about the event taking place here. And he must needs go through Samaria. Then cometh he to a city of Samaria, which is called Sychar, near the parcel of ground that Jacob gave to his son Joseph. Now Jacob's well was there. Jesus therefore, being wearied with his journey, sat thus on the well, and it was about the sixth hour. There cometh a woman of Samaria to draw water. Jesus saith unto her, give me to drink. For his disciples were gone away into the city to buy meat. Then saith the woman of Samaria unto him, how is it that thou, being a Jew, askest drink of me, which am a woman of Samaria? For the Jews have no dealings with the Samaritans. Jesus answered and said unto her, if thou knewest the gift of God, and who it is that saith to thee, give me to drink, thou wouldest have asked him, and he would have given thee living water. The woman saith unto him, sir, thou hast nothing to draw with, and the well is deep. From whence, then, hast thou that living water? Art thou greater than our father Jacob, which gave us the well, and drank thereof himself, and his children, and his cattle? Jesus answered and said unto her, whosoever drinketh of this water shall thirst again. But whosoever drinketh of the water that I shall give him shall never thirst. But the water that I shall give him shall be in him a well of water springing up into everlasting life. The woman saith unto him, sir, give me this water, that I thirst not, neither come hither to draw. Jesus saith unto her, go, call thy husband, and come hither. The woman answered and said, I have no husband. Jesus said unto her, thou hast well said, I have no husband. For thou hast had five husbands, and he whom thou now hast, is not thy husband. And that saidst thou truly. The woman saith unto him, sir, I perceive that thou art a prophet. Our fathers worshipped in this mountain, and ye say that in Jerusalem is the place where men ought to worship. Jesus saith unto her, woman, believe me, the hour cometh when ye shall neither in this mountain nor yet at Jerusalem worship the Father. Ye worship, ye know not what. We know what we worship, for salvation is of the Jews. But the hour cometh, and now is, when the true worshippers shall worship the Father in spirit and in truth. For the Father seeketh such to worship him. God is a spirit, and they that worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth. Okay, so Jesus has just taught a very valuable lesson here to the Samaritan woman. We continue to read, and it's not just a couple of verses further, and we find the disciples coming and seeing. And in verse 27 of the King James Version, it says that they marveled at what was taking place. They marveled that he talked with the woman, yet no man said, what seekest thou, or why talkest thou with her? Right. It seems that finally they feel like they've been, or we get the feeling that they've seen enough of Jesus that to understand that he has his reasons for doing something. And so they don't question it necessarily. You remember in other places they try to run the children off, and Jesus rebukes them. They try to keep the multitude from coming to him, and Jesus rebukes them. And so they've learned their lesson here. They're not going to try to run this woman off. Finally the woman goes and they try to give him some food, and Jesus says, "I have meat that you know not of." They're still, even at this point, they're still very carnally or physically minded at this point. They're still not looking at the big picture. They're still not getting the idea that these things, all these things that Jesus is trying to teach them are spiritual in nature. Alright, as we look at the woman at the well, what are some facts that we gather from Jesus' conversation with this woman? Okay. Jesus knew all about her. He knew something about her that he could not have possibly known. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And that's what we're getting at when we're talking about he's got lessons to teach his disciples. We make this about the woman at the well, and rightly so. I mean, we get great lessons from the woman at the well. But why did Jesus have to go through Samaria? It wasn't because of the woman at the well. It wasn't because of this city, this entire city that was going to believe on him. It wasn't because of that. He needed his disciples to come to grips with the idea that salvation was for more than just them. He's teaching, he's giving them this lesson that he has come not just for the kingdom of the Jews, but he's come for the entire world. Okay, and so he's giving them this lesson. This is about more than just this woman that we're studying about this morning. This is about the disciples in a great degree. And big part of that happened right here in John chapter 4, where we see this taking place. Yes, ma'am. The Canaanite? Yes, ma'am. Why what? A lot of times with that is the idea, is to test their belief. The 10 lepers. Okay? What if they had just decided, I mean, even as Jesus told them what they needed to do, what if they decided not to do that? We're not going to go show ourselves to the priest. You know, we're on our way to go do that. They show their belief, and so before they ever get to the priest, they're healed. Okay? And then, of course, the one returns. But they still had to go show themselves to the priest. Okay? What if they had just decided, you know, once we're healed, we're not going to go to the priest? Then no doubt in my mind, that leprosy is coming back. But so, you know, he refuses her there, I believe, is to test her belief. The rich young ruler. One thing thou lackest. He decided he didn't want to do that. And so the big part of that is testing their faith. And her response shows that.
I think that's absolutely correct, but I think there's an opposite side of that. That's a demonstrator.
Right.
He's testing her faith. But then there are others right that are around there, the disciples being a part of it. But they need to see her faith.
Right. Oh, absolutely. I mean, and to demonstrate her faith, you know, being a Canaanite, someone that's not of the kingdom of the Jews, You got the, again, the 10 lepers, they demonstrate their faith, in going and doing it, as Jesus said. You got just about all of these miracles that are performed. Each one of them had to demonstrate their faith. I believe and it's done. They had to do something. The woman that touched his garment, Jesus didn't challenge her or anything like that, but she was so full of faith that she said, if I can just touch his clothes. And that demonstrated her faith. And so, you go to the book of James, and that's the idea of faith and works. They had to do something. That was with the Canaanite woman. The thing here with the woman at the well. It took her a little while, but when she realized who Jesus was, what'd she do? All right, she didn't just go and tell, but she laid every weight aside, didn't she? She left her pots at the well. And then she went running back into the city. She showed her priority. Now, as Jesus is talking to her, all right, we're talking about the woman at the well. Some facts that Jesus presents, and a couple talking points that we could get on here. He tells her what concerning her marriage situation. All right, she told the truth when she said, "I have no husband." All right, so what do we learn at this point about the man that she is living with? Not her husband, huh? They're living in adultery and they're not married. Okay, so a couple of things there. Something I want to point out, and we're not going to get in depth in this, but I would like for you, if you get the chance to study on this as well. Does God recognize subsequent marriages even if they're not scriptural? He does here. She's had five what? Husbands. Did he recognize those marriages? He recognized them. They weren't right, but he recognized them. Okay? So that's something for us to consider there. Yes, sir. Mm-hmm. Right. Now, what I'm getting at here is, in the world that we live in, okay, and all the divorces and all the broken homes and all of this, there are those, even within our city, and think about to whom Jesus is talking here. Okay? She's not a Jew. She's not necessarily, adhering to the law of Moses because she hasn't been worshiping in Jerusalem. She hasn't been doing these things. And yet, what do we find Jesus doing here with her? He's holding her accountable. Okay? There are those even within our city, within the Lord's church that teach that if one is not a member of the Lord's church, then they are not amenable to the laws of God concerning marriage. There's something wrong with that. As Jesus is recognizing her marriages here and saying to her that you have well said the man that you have no husband for the one that you're with now, you've had five and the one you're with now is not your husband. God recognized those marriages, even though they weren't scriptural. And he says, you're responsible for these. Even though she's not necessarily living under the law of Moses. She's not a Jew. She was not born into that covenant relationship. And God says, Jesus is God. God says you're accountable at this point. Okay, so that's something that we have to realize. We may have made a mistake when we were 17, 18, 19, 20 years old. We were young and dumb. But is God still hold us accountable for those mistakes? If you're old enough to make the decision, then you're held accountable for those mistakes. I had a conversation with a man in Alabama He was in a right relationship as far as his marriage goes, and he just knew a young lady. Got married when she was 18, I think. Divorced by 20. And member of the church, he was, and we were having this conversation, and he just said, "Josh, I cannot believe that God would want her to live the rest of her life alone." And, you know, first of all, we had to clarify that wasn't God's fault. God did not force her to be married. And two is, what can we do other than show that young lady the scriptures? You can't do anything else. You show her the scriptures, and then who's it left up to? It's up to her. Okay? God has made it clear, but we can't make that decision. As far as, you know, I can't tell her, you know, this is wrong, this is right. That's up to her. Okay? I can show her what's right and what's wrong. But that's up to her as to what she does with that information. So, that's just something for us to ponder on there when it comes to this woman and her marriages. Something for us to think about and something for us to study. Alright, when we continue, she makes a point here. Verse 19, he's told her this, and she says, "Sir, I perceive that you're a prophet." Okay. "Our fathers worshipped in this mountain. Ye say that in Jerusalem is the place where men ought to worship." It looks as if here, she is searching for the truth. Okay. Maybe she's had these questions before. Why do our cousins, that's what they were, why do our cousins, the Jews, why do they say that we have to worship at Jerusalem, and yet our fathers have always taught us that we worship here on this mountain? All right, what mountain is she talking about, by the way? Huh? No. Sorry? Gerizim. Mount Gerizim. Okay? There were two mountains under the law of Moses that were to be used every year. Gerizim was one of them. Alright? The other one was Mount Ebal. E-B-A-L. If you want a distinction between the two, remember G, Gerizim is for good, and Ebal, E is for evil. Okay? Good versus evil. Every year, the high priest or somebody was to stand upon Mount Ebal and read the cursings, from the law of Moses. And then they were to go over here and stand on Mount Gerizim before the entire congregation and read the blessings under the law of Moses. Okay, and so they worshiped, the Samaritans did, they worshiped upon the mountain of blessings. And so that's where they said they had to worship. The Jews said, "No, you gotta come to Jerusalem." And so she may have been asking these questions before. We worship God over here, but you say we have to go to Jerusalem. And so now she realizes, she recognizes she has somebody here that can answer that question. I have before me a prophet. I'm going to ask the hard questions. Nobody here can answer me. You can. And so she asked Jesus this question about worship. Now I find it interesting. Jesus' response. This is probably, and really it's the only time I can think of that Jesus either doesn't answer with a question of his own, or he doesn't give a real direct answer. Now the answer is direct, don't get me wrong, but I mean he doesn't directly answer her question. Yes, you have to worship in Jerusalem or you can worship here in this mountain. He answers her question by giving her a completely different, unexpected answer. Look at what he says. "Jesus saith unto her, Woman, believe me, the hour cometh when ye shall neither in this mountain nor yet at Jerusalem worship the Father." Okay, he's right here in verse 21, he's laying the groundwork to tell her that worship is more than just where you go. It's in how you do it, and what you do, as far as what God prescribes. Verse 22, "Ye worship, you know not what." What's he mean by that? All right, worship is false. How do we gather that? Could agree. Yes, ma'am. What happened? Okay. Where did Samaritans come from? Maybe we should have covered that first. Where did Samaritans come from? Okay. Not necessarily Babylonian, but the Assyrian captivity that took the northern kingdom away. Okay. Babylon wasn't the first to come up with this idea to relocate the peoples that they conquered. Okay, the Assyrians came in, they took away the northern tribes, carried them out of the land. There would have been a few left behind, I'm sure. They're not going to take everybody out. But what they did is they took folks from other lands they had conquered and they relocated them to Samaria. So the ones that were relocated to Samaria intermingled with the ones that were left there and those that would return, that would trickle back in later on when the Persian king would allow them to return. And they intermarried, and so what do you end up having? Okay, you have an entirely different race for one, and then two, you, as was pointed out, they were made up of idol worshipers. And what's happening in the land, when these idol worshipers first come in? You remember? Lions and bears and other wild animals were killing a lot of people. And their mind, rightly so, but their mind said, you know, they're thinking they're superstitious anyway. All idol worshipers are very superstitious. And they're saying the gods are causing this. And so the God of this land doesn't really want us here because we don't know who he is. We're not worshiping him. And so what happens is the Assyrian king sends a priest from this land to teach them about the God of the land, teach them about the God of heaven. And so they're able to stymie the lion attacks and the bear attacks and everything. And so what you really end up having happen in the area of Samaria is we'll take a little bit from the worship of this God, a little bit from the worship of this God, a little bit from the God of heaven, and we'll put it all together, and we'll worship this way. And so when Jesus says to her, you worship you know not what, it's false worship, it's idol worship, and it gets nowhere. And Jesus says, not only you know you worship you know not what, he says, we know what we worship. What's he mean by that? Okay, we know the God of heaven. We know what we worship. Okay, idols, what are idols anyway? Well, they're false gods, but what are they? Okay, they believe they needed something physical, so what would they do? Well, I mean, literally, physically, what were idols? Alright, they made something with their hands. Most of the time what it is they find, the biggest tree in the immediate area. They'd cut it down, they carve it into their idol, and then they'd overlay it with gold or bronze or whatever. Okay? And this was their God as they worshiped it. Okay? And so, that's literally what it was. So Jesus says, you don't know what you worship. We know what we worship. And then he goes on, he doesn't just stop there. He says, for salvation is of the Jews. He's quoting scripture. Okay, he's telling her. Salvation is of the Jews. And so, where is salvation going to come from? Through the Jews. Through the tribe of Judah. She doesn't know it, but she's talking to salvation. She doesn't know it yet. She gets the picture here in just a minute. Okay. And then verse 23, but the hour cometh and now is when the true worshipers, what's he mean by that? Alright, who does this include? True worshipers. Christians. Okay, so we're not talking about Jews, we're not talking about Gentiles, we're not talking about male or female, We're not talking about slave or free. True worshipers. Who are we talking about? All those that would truly worship God. Christians shall worship the Father in spirit and in truth. Okay, so Jesus says worship to the Father here. Before we even get to verse 24, he says worship to the Father. Those that would worship him will worship the Father in spirit and in truth, for the Father seeketh such to worship him. Jesus is telling us here that worship is more than just the place and the what, or what we do. Right? What were the Jews guilty of for so many years when it came to worship? Were they worshiping the right God? They were. They were worshiping the right God, but were they worshiping him in the right way? Not at all. Okay, so they were worshiping the right God. They got the truth part right. They didn't get the spirit part right. Okay? On the other hand, the Samaritans, they got the spirit part right, but they didn't get the truth part right. And that's why Jesus says what he says. Here we have so many, and Jesus already confronted a bunch of them, hadn't he? That are worshiping God as far as the what and the physical part of the worship, they were doing what they needed to do. Okay? Could you fault the Pharisees for their acts of worship? Not in the least. As a matter of fact, what did Jesus tell his disciples concerning the Pharisees? Do what they tell you to do. Do what they teach. Because that's the proper way as far as the physical acts of worship. That's how you worship God. But you don't do what they do. In other words, you don't have their spirit. You don't have their attitude. You don't follow their example as far as their lives go. Okay? So he says, worship, and in verse 24, God is a spirit. Okay? He's telling her right here, he's not an idol. He's not some physical thing that you can put your hands on or anything like that. And they that worship him must worship him. An imperative then. Must worship him how? In spirit and in truth. Okay, can we get the truth part right and not the spirit part and be right with God? No. Can we get the spirit part right? We love to worship God. We're excited about coming to worship. We're wanting to do what God wants us to do, but we don't have the truth. Is that right? That's not right. That's not acceptable. And Jesus tells her that. How must we worship God? They must worship how? In spirit. What does that mean exactly? All right, it's the right attitude, but it's so much more than that. All right, mindfulness. Okay. You have to know the Bible, you have to know the truth. Your spirit has to be in spirit's Christ. It's mindfulness, it's attitude. Friends, when we're talking about worshiping in spirit, and this is something that I've had to work on, and it's something that I think that the Lord's church, most of the places that I've been, need to work on. When we come to worship, are we excited about it? Or is it something that we feel that we have to do? We should be excited about it. It is a privilege to worship God. It is a privilege to come before the throne of God, to be able to offer prayers unto Him, to be able to offer songs of praise, to be able to keep in memory the Lord's death for us every week. This should be something that we should be excited about, and yet so many of the Lord's church come to worship with a frown on their face. We're preoccupied with what we're going to do for lunch, who's playing football today, what happened yesterday. We're so preoccupied, and a lot of it is the world that we live in. I get that. But friends, as Christians, we've got to put that stuff, we've got to leave that stuff outside when we come together. When we're talking about worshiping in spirit, we've had it beaten into us, and I have too. We've had it beaten into us so long that we worship God without emotion, that we can't show any kind of emotion or anything like that. That it almost seems, and it may not be like this on purpose, but it almost seems like we're just going through the motions. Where's our emotion as we sing? We used to have a man at Glendale that when he would lead a prayer, the most heartfelt prayer you ever heard, whenever he would stand before the congregation and he would lead us in prayer, you knew at some point in that prayer his voice was going to crack as he went to God in prayer. And it's because he poured himself into that prayer. I don't know about the rest. I can't judge his heart. I don't know about the rest of his worship, but I know with his prayers, you could see it and you could hear it. That he gave his all to God in that moment. But friends, when we worship our God, it's about our emotion. It's about our attitude. It's about our mindfulness. It's about where our mind's at. It's about what we're thinking about. Our mind ought to be centered upon God. But really, when's the last time? Let me ask you this, and maybe this will get the point across. When's the last time that you left worship exhausted? Friends, we ought to leave worship. And I want to challenge you this morning that you put your everything into our worship this morning. You sing with everything you've got. You pray fervently before God as we go to Him in prayer. You keep your mind centered upon Jesus as we partake of the Lord's Supper. You think about what you're doing as you place your cash or your check in the plate. Leave worship this morning exhausted because you've put your everything into it. That's what Jesus is talking about when He says, they that worship Him must worship Him in spirit. Now, the in truth part, that's simple to understand, isn't it? What's the in truth part mean? According to His Word. Simple as that. God has told us what we need to do to worship Him. We just follow it. Nadab and Abihu missed that memo, didn't they? They paid the ultimate consequence. And so we have to understand that when it comes to worship, just as look, I'm not going to question many folks that are in denominations as far as their spirit part of their worship. I mean, they're enthusiastic. They pour themselves into their worship, but see, what they're missing is the truth. There's no doubt in my mind the Samaritan woman, when she would go to this Mount Gerizim and she would worship, not really knowing what she worshiped, but that she put her all into it. But Jesus said, you're missing the truth. And they that worship God, what do you have to do? You've got to put them together. And if they're not together, then the worship's not acceptable. It's not right before God. So not only must we worship God strictly according to His Word, we've got to pour ourselves into it. Why did Abraham get up so early to go offer Isaac? I cannot believe for a minute that he was excited to kill his son. But Hebrews chapter 11 tells us what? God could raise him from the dead. So he didn't worry about it. He did what God told him to do. And he did it fervently. Poured himself into it. Okay, so that's what we're talking about. We're talking about the woman at the well. The Sermon on the Mount. Let me give you a breakdown here. We're just not going to have time to really get into it. But I'll give you a kind of an outline of the Sermon on the Mount. Matthew chapter 5 beginning, through chapter 7. Matthew 5, 1 through 12 teaches us what true happiness is. Okay, the word blessed or blessed, in the first 12 verses literally means happy. So when you read that, blessed is he, blessed is he, blessed is he, you can actually read that, happy is he. Happy is he that mourns, happy is he that is lowly in spirit, so forth, so on. Verses 13 through 16, a passage that is often quoted concerning our being salt and being a light unto the world, is there teaching, and basically that teaches us that we ought to live godly before all men. because folks are watching. Okay, so our light is to shine. Verses 17 through 20 shows the purpose of Christ was not to destroy the old law, but rather to fulfill it. Okay, so he came not to destroy the old law, but to fulfill it. It would have fulfilled its purpose in him. Verses 21 through 48 in chapter 5 discuss Jewish traditions, and Jesus comments on the contrast between traditions and the meaning of God's law concerning the related subjects. So basically what Jesus says is man's traditions down here, God's law up here. Okay? The Pharisees got angry with Jesus and his disciples on several occasions, not because they broke God's law, but what? They broke with tradition. Okay? Moses never said that a person had to wash his hands before he sat down to eat. But the Pharisees did. And they held their tradition on an equal plane. Jesus says that's not right. Tradition does not hold the same weight as does God's law. All right, chapter 6, 1 through 8, or 1 through 18 rather, admonishes men not to be hypocrites. Verses 19 through 34 of chapter 6 tells us how to have real security and how to avoid anxiety. Matthew 6 and verse 33 says what? Seek ye what? Seek ye first the kingdom of God and His righteousness and all these things, all these physical needs that you have, God will see to them. Chapter 7 discusses some other subjects, judging, the golden rule, warning against false prophets, and a few others. So there's you a brief outline of the Sermon on the Mount. All right, Wednesday night, we're going to have a lot to discuss, but Wednesday night we're going to look at the Passion Week, the last week of Jesus' life. We'll look at the Resurrection and the Great Commission. All right, so if you want to look over those things, the Passion Week, the Resurrection, and the Great Commission, we'll get to those on Wednesday night.